Hello, everyone. Welcome to part two of the Jacob Wetterling case. As a little recap, part one covered the 8 assaults of the boys in Painesville, Minnesota, and the kidnapping and assault of 12-year-old Jared Shirell in January of 1989 in nearby Cold Spring. They come up with 25-year-old Danny Heinrich as a suspect. Danny Heinrich is then put in a lineup for Jared as he picks out Heinrich and another man as resembling the man who attacked him. Then came October 22, 1989, when Jacob Wetterling was kidnapped on a road that connected to Dan Rassier's driveway. Dan Rassier remembers seeing two cars turn around in his driveway the night that Jacob was abducted, but police look at him as possibly being a person of interest rather than a witness. Then, just 2 days after Jacob was abducted, a sophomore boy and his dad go to the Stearns County Police Department and tell them about the Painesville attacks, and they say that they think the same guy responsible for those attacks has Jacob. But the police of Stearns County don't follow up with that lead. Not yet, anyway. Less than a week after Jacob's disappearance, Patty and Jerry Wetterling, Jacob's parents, go on a TV show with Maury Povich in hopes to get the word out that Jacob is missing and to find him alive. Let's get straight into part two. Parents became worried for their own children's safety. According to APM reports, a woman named Robbie Burr said, quote, "I know my little boy's 5 and he won't go outside. Yesterday he didn't want to go out and play and he was up last night and it's scary for the kids, anybody really," end quote. Minneapolis and St. Paul business leaders even offer a $100,000 reward for Jacob's safe return. Deputies end up searching on horseback looking for anything they can, any clues at all, and the FBI has 20 agents assigned to the case at this point, again just 4 days after the abduction. The next day, October 27, 1989, the governor of Minnesota activated the National Guard, State Patrol, and the Department of Natural Resources to search a 700-square-mile area for Jacob. And the Wetterlings also did an interview on CBS This Morning in hopes of getting word out to everyone possible. The entire state of Minnesota is doing everything they can to find this boy. Radio stations across the entire state played his favorite song, which was Listen by Red Grammer. Along with the song, they played a message for Jacob from his mother Patty in hopes that he would somehow hear it. As she's fighting back tears, Patty says, quote, "I just want Jacob to know that this song is for him to hear. The heartbeat of humanity is beating for him. I know it will give him strength. If there's an ounce of compassion in the man who's holding him, he will let him go safely. Listen, Jacob, can you hear our prayers? We love you," end quote. Patty and Jerry were interviewed for multiple news broadcasts sharing that they're looking for Jacob. During one interview, Patty says, quote, "Nobody knows what to do. This doesn't happen here. You hear that all the time. I mean, we lived here because it's peaceful and quiet," end quote. Then, about a week after Jacob's abduction, something really, I think, kind of cool happened. Thousands of people came together to actually form a human chain that stretched for 3 miles. They walked down a main road in the cold, and the chain even consisted of 2 Minnesota Twins baseball players who were wearing blue warm-up jackets that had Jacob's initials on them. Another baseball player who made it known that he was in support of finding Jacob as well was Terry Steinbach, who is from Minnesota, but at the time was playing baseball for Oakland. Well, during the 1989 World Series, he wore a J for Jacob on the back of his batting helmet. The Wetterlings had hoped that all the publicity that Jacob's case was getting would end up getting them the lead that they needed, the one that brought them to Jacob. As the days went by, the search continued, though, and it actually grew to include pretty much all of Minnesota, and then to include most of the Midwest, and then Canada, and then the world. There was no telling where Jacob was. The community of St. Joseph came together to find Jacob. Hundreds of people started looking for him without the help of law enforcement. They were doing it all on their own because that's what these small-town, tight-knit communities do. They searched roads, ditches, abandoned buildings, barns, fields, the woods, anywhere and everywhere. Flyers were made with Jacob's photo and description on them. They put them up everywhere, in stores, on power poles, even on parked cars. And then came Jacob's hope. People would wear white ribbons pinned to their shirts to symbolize hope for Jacob and his safe return. Now remember, police are keeping an eye on Dan Rassier as a person of interest. I don't know if he's literally their main and only focus, but they seem to put a lot of effort into him. So it's about a week after Jacob's been missing at this point, and police again show up at Dan's farm. This time they do a more thorough search of his property and his house. They seem very interested in his bedroom because that seems to be where they do most of their searching. According to APM reports, Dan says, quote, "They were trying to find something, but there was nothing to find," end quote. And that night, police give him a lie detector test, which he passed. They again have nothing to arrest Dan on, so for now they let him go. Then, on November 1st, 1989, 10 days after Jacob disappeared, a newscast is aired on NBC with Patty and Jerry Wetterling. Patty says she really thought Jacob would be home the next morning. Each day that brings hope also brings another day of loneliness and fear. According to APM reports, on this same day, a nationwide mailing campaign is launched to notify hospitals, truck stops, social agencies, and others about Jacob's abduction. There were 1 million flyers that were sent out around the entire country. By the end of the second week that Jacob was missing, there were almost 100 officers working on the case. Helicopters were scanning the town, officers were riding horseback through fields, people were even driving four-wheelers, or ATVs, down gravel roads looking for any sign of Jacob. There were thousands of volunteers searching. According to the episode of In the Dark, Jacob's search was the largest search for a missing child in United States history. In the week that followed, more famous people, or local famous people in Minnesota anyway, started actually getting involved. Remember earlier I said that two Minnesota Twins baseball players were part of that human chain? Well, now more Twins baseball players were becoming involved in showing their support for finding Jacob. And during a Minnesota Vikings football game, there were banners displayed stating that they were still searching for Jacob. The Minnesota Timberwolves basketball team even donated proceeds from the tickets sold to their first home game to help aid in the search for Jacob. And during this time, a sketch is also released. Investigators received a tip of a suspicious man seen at the convenience store where the boys rented the movie from on the night of Jacob's abduction. They've been trying to find this man, but they just can't track him down. They describe him as being a white man in his 50s, about 200 pounds, with white hair, and they describe him as glaring at customers. Then, about a week later, police release two more sketches. One is of a man who was heard talking about the abduction 2 weeks after it happened in the same convenience store the boys were. The second sketch is of a man thought to have tried to abduct a boy in New Brighton, Minnesota, which is about an hour from St. Joseph, where Jacob was taken. These two sketches match the previous sketch of the man in the convenience store glaring at people. After these sketches are released, tips come literally pouring in, but they're not any tips that bring them closer to finding Jacob. Patty and Jerry Wetterling are doing everything they can to find their son. They give interviews almost daily in hopes of reminding everyone that Jacob is out there somewhere. They just need to find him. According to the episode of In the Dark, Patty says, quote, "I wanted everybody in the world looking for Jacob. We did what we had to, what we felt we had to," end quote. Then, 3 weeks after Jacob was abducted, Patty and Jerry were on the daytime talk show with Geraldo Rivera. The show also featured John Walsh, who many know as the host of America's Most Wanted. He has a son who was murdered 8 years prior to Jacob's abduction. Patty and Jerry were, I believe, in the living room of their house, or the basement maybe. They weren't actually on a stage for the show. And unfortunately, the show didn't go as Patty Wetterling had hoped. Instead of feeling that the show helped in their search for Jacob, it seems the show actually made a spectacle about his disappearance. Geraldo mentions horrifying situations or incidents that may have happened to Jacob instead of finding him alive and safe. He asks Patty if she has nightmares as she looks for a reason why Jacob was taken. Patty says, quote, "I can't answer those questions. I choose not to think about all the horrible options you made mention of at the beginning. I just won't allow those into my mind. At this point, I just want to believe that he's fine and we're going to get him home. I don't have nightmares, no." End quote. John Walsh says, quote, "I know what they're going through. They're going through the nightmare of not knowing. They're going and hoping that sometimes in a rare incidence, a child has gotten back that's been gone for a long time. But all of the people that are sitting there today know the harsh reality that lots of kids that are not taken by some caring person and taken to Disneyland. They're taken by someone who is into sexually assaulting children. And if you're lucky, you'll find the body in a field." End quote. Now, I think the host of In the Dark says it best to describe Patty's behavior. She says, quote, "Patty stared at the ground as though she was trying to redirect all of her anger away from Geraldo and John Walsh and onto a few inches of basement carpet," end quote. Geraldo then asks John Walsh, quote, "What can they, the Wetterlings, do? Are they in a sense of powerless now to the whims, the whimsy, the awful capriciousness of this madman?" end quote. And John Walsh answers, quote, "That would be my opinion," end quote. Geraldo ends with, quote, "To all our parents, to their children who are out there, our prayers to you. We love you. Come home soon," end quote. Patty then actually tears the microphone off her shirt and throws it to the ground, visibly upset by the interview that just took place. She says, quote, "They used us. We had this sensational kidnapping and they used us," end quote. Even though the Geraldo interview didn't go how Patty had hoped, it did create new leads in the search for Jacob, just as other media appearances after the show did. There were thousands of new leads for detectives to look at. Sheriff Graft ended up having to set up a 24-hour call center just to be able to keep up with all the leads that were pouring in. Now again, to best describe how they ended up getting so many leads, I'm going to turn to the host of In the Dark. She says, quote, "Investigators would get a tip about something, like a white van, and they'd publicize it. And then people started seeing white vans everywhere and would call them in. One tip about a white van would turn into hundreds of tips about other white vans. Officers would try to find those vans too," end quote. Some people would even call the Wetterlings directly with leads, so the sheriff gave them a separate phone to record those calls. One of the tips that came in was from a man claiming that he worked for the FBI and that he's a psychic, and says he actually is one of the best. Patty answers the phone when this man calls, and when she does, the first thing he says is, "Have you got our letters?" And Patty says, "Well, you have to tell me more. We get thousands of letters." Then the man says something rather odd. He says, quote, "I want to ask you a question right quick. Is there anybody in your family, either side, with their legs off?" End quote. And Patty says, "No, not that I know of." And he says, "One of the men that has Jacob doesn't have any legs." He says he knows what the man who abducted Jacob looks like, and that he is sick to death of seeing what this legless man did to Jacob. He then tells Patty, quote, "This boy was raped on the side of the school bus right there where you live," end quote. And Patty cuts him off and says, quote, "You can't tell me that information without telling me where Jacob is. That doesn't help me to know," end quote. The man then apologizes and tell her, "Jacob's all right, he's alive." And that's not the strangest call Patty has gotten. Sometimes people would actually call pretending to have Jacob, and some of them even called pretending to be Jacob. Patty says, quote, "The phone, it's a gift and a nightmare. You can't not answer the phone, and that's a killer," end quote. So now back to Dan Rassier, and I'll tell you now, he's going to come up quite a bit. So remember about a week after Jacob disappeared, they went back to his farm and they did a more thorough search. They searched his house and then they had him submit to a lie detector test. Well, then, about 3 to 4 weeks after Jacob was taken, they hypnotized Dan. If you listened to one of our previous episodes, The Attack on Mary Vincent, I briefly mentioned hypnosis in her case as well. This is a tool that's used to try to jog someone's memory, to sort of bring them back to that very moment so they can recall every detail of what they saw and what happened. So detectives drove Dan from his home in St. Joseph to the Twin Cities, which is like a little over an hour or so away, to go through this hypnosis. The person conducting the hypnosis wanted him to recall details from that night, to give a better description of the car, to remember the license plate number. They just keep pressing him. You say you saw a car, tell us more. What else did you notice about it? Come on, tell us more. But all he could come up with is that it was dark in color, maybe blue. He couldn't give them any more details. What he did remember, though, is seeing a person in the passenger seat of the car. A woman or maybe a child. But afterwards, Dan says he isn't sure if that was actually even a real memory or if he just sort of made it up while he was under that hypnosis. Police couldn't arrest Dan or anything, so they just had to let him go for the time being. And again, he was still on their radar while time passed. And unfortunately, as time passes, they don't get any closer to finding Jacob. According to APM reports, on November 20th, 1989, almost a full month since Jacob's been missing, 6 Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension agents and 5 FBI agents are taken off the case. Now, even though agents are taken off the case, they aren't stopping the search for Jacob. On November 30th, 1989, 10 days after those agents were removed, investigators release a new sketch of a man they're looking for. They say this is a more accurate and detailed sketch of the man, so they're hoping someone will recognize it. Now, Jacob's parents are doing everything they can to find their son. According to In the Dark, they even contacted psychics to try to find Jacob, or rather Jerry, Jacob's father, was in touch with the psychics. Patty stayed more with law enforcement, where Jerry would talk to psychics and even send them items that belonged to Jacob to help in their psychic abilities, I guess. About a month after Jacob was abducted, investigators spent 2 days searching an area near Mason City, Iowa, which was prompted due to a lead that they received from a psychic in New York, but nothing was found. And one thing that was still strange is investigators still hadn't talked to all the Wetterling neighbors. I would think that that would be one of the first things you'd want to do, see if any of them saw anything suspicious. I mean, they're chasing leads from psychics, but not interviewing people who lived right next door to where Jacob was abducted. Then, in mid-December, FBI agents meet with Jared Shire. Remember, he's the 12-year-old boy who was assaulted near Cold Spring in January of that year. According to In the Dark, when Jared heard about Jacob's abduction, his heart sank. He immediately thought of the man who kidnapped and assaulted him. He says, quote, "There were details that I recognized right away that indicated it was the same demeanor. Some of the phrases were similar, description of the voice was similar," end quote. Jared details the man who kidnapped and assaulted him, and a sketch is created for this man. Now again, one would think, or like to think, that investigators would be a little more kind to a 12-year-old boy who was kidnapped and sexually assaulted. But according to NPR News, Jared recalls how they were actually quite rude to him and very pushy. He was interviewed multiple times after Jacob's abduction, and he recalls his interview with them in December of 1989. He says investigators actually accused him of knowing the man who did this to him, and they kept telling him, you know, another boy is still missing, and they would say things like, we know you know who did this to you, now tell us who it is. They tried to put pressure on him and constantly say, there's another boy missing, you have the answer. They'd say, if you don't tell us who this man is, we'll never find Jacob. Jared says, quote, those words stuck with me forever, end quote. Jared ended up being so upset during this interview because he didn't know who did this to him. He broke down in tears during the interview with investigators, which, by the way, his parents weren't allowed to be in the room with him. When Jared walked out of the room, his parents saw his reaction and what the interview had done to him. They told investigators, enough is enough, no more interviews, were done. His parents really did mean that they had enough. Enough so that they moved. They moved from Cold Spring to Painesville. Now, Jared and his family had no idea about the Painesville attacks on the young boys that were Jared's age. They just wanted to move to hopefully find people who didn't know who they were and didn't know what had happened to Jared. Now, just a few days after the sketch Jared helped with is released, FBI agents go back to Danny Heinrich. Remember, he was originally a suspect in Jared's case just a few days after Jared was assaulted. Jared picked him and another guy out in a lineup. But they couldn't match his car to the car Jared remembered from his assault, and ultimately, Danny Heinrich was never charged or anything. Well, now it's 11 months later, and they're back to him. They interview him again, but again, he denies having any knowledge of Jacob's abduction or of what happened to Jared. He only lives about 30 miles from St. Joseph, where Jacob was taken, but they can't prove anything. He's denying knowing anything about the kidnappings, so again, they just have to let him go. But he is still on their radar. Now remember, I said after less than 24 hours of Jacob being kidnapped, a high school boy and his father went to the Stearns County Sheriff's Office. There, they told investigators about those Painesville attacks, two of which the boy had witnessed himself, and they urged the investigators to speak with Painesville police because they think it's the same guy who took Jacob. Well, now it's about 2.5 months after Jacob disappeared, and they're finally making contact with Painesville police. So, they waited 2.5 months to actually follow up with this lead. On January 5th, 1990, they speak with Painesville police, and guess who they're led back to again? Danny Heinrich. He was a suspect in the Painesville assaults, and the Painesville Police Department says Stearns County officers should really take a good look at him again. So, a few days later, they go back to Danny Heinrich and question him yet again. They take photographs of the tires on his blue Ford EXP, which is like a little sporty type car. The tires on his car are Sears brand, and the tracks at the crime scene are from a Sears brand tire. Heinrich was actually very cooperative and even consented to them searching his car as well. According to APM reports, the detective concludes that Heinrich's tires are consistent to the tire tracks at the crime scene. The detective also looks at the soles of Heinrich's shoes and finds that they seem to be consistent with the shoe print pattern at the crime scene as well. The detectives take his shoes for analyzing to see if they can get an accurate or exact match, and the shoes come back as a match to the prints at the scene. They also take samples of his body hair. And it's also noted that Heinrich shared a strong resemblance to the one sketch that Jared Shirell helped investigators put together. Then, according to the Twin Cities Pioneer Press, they have Heinrich take a lie detector test. And he doesn't exactly pass. He ends up actually registering as deceptive on all the questions related to Jacob Wetterling, Jared Shirell, and the Painesville attacks. Now, what they end up doing is actually placing Heinrich under surveillance. And during this time, they start interviewing people who know him. They begin their surveillance at 8:19 p.m. on January 12, 1990. And almost immediately, they see him get into his car, so they follow him. Now, while they're trailing him, some very odd, and I guess some things that make him look guilty, happen. It appears that he knows he's being followed, because he makes numerous, and it seems random, turns on roads outside of Painesville, and within 20 minutes, he turns off his lights, and the investigators end up losing him. Over the next 2 days, investigators continue to follow him. They follow him home, they follow him to local bars, and then, for whatever reason, they stop their surveillance. They followed him for only 3 days. Now, if you ask me, an innocent man wouldn't be taking driving maneuvers to escape them. One thing they do, though, is they end up gaining access to Heinrich's 1987 Mercury Topaz, which is the car he owned when Jared's attack took place. So at this point, Heinrich actually doesn't own the car anymore, so they had to search for it. So they have Jared sit in the car, and they ask him, how similar is this car to the one from your attack? Jared says, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's like an 8 or a 9, meaning it's very similar to the car he remembers from a year ago. About a week later, on January 24, 1990, investigators search Heinrich's home, which is owned by his father. Now, he'd been living here since November of 1989, so the month after Jacob disappeared. What they're looking for is Jacob, or his clothing, a gun, documents, any other material that has anything to do with Jacob's disappearance. They end up finding two police scanners, a carrying case, lists of scanner frequencies, a pair of boots, and some of Heinrich's clothing, all of which they confiscate. During the search, Heinrich tells the investigators, "You know, when that kid was taken, I was most likely at home. I wasn't even in St. Joseph." But then investigators find something pretty incriminating. They discover a trunk in Heinrich's home that contains pictures of children. One of the photos is of a boy with a towel wrapped around himself. And another is a picture of a boy in his underwear. Now, Heinrich actually objects to the investigators taking these photos. And later, when he is asked about them again, he says, "I don't have the pictures anymore because I actually burned them." According to APM reports, on January 26, 2 days after searching Heinrich's home, investigators have him stand in a lineup for three boys to pick out. Two of the boys had reported seeing a suspicious man in a car near the Wetterlings' home the week prior to Jacob's abduction. And the third boy is Jared Shirell. Now, unfortunately, none of the boys picked out any of the men as the one they saw, or for Jared as the one who attacked him. Now, in, I believe it was 2018, a man named Don Gudmundson was the Stearns County Sheriff, and he brings up a very good point. According to APM reports, he says Jared should have been allowed to hear the men talk so that he could tell if maybe one of them matched the voice of his abductor. And I mean, that absolutely makes sense. This is a year after Jared's assault. People can easily change their appearance, but they can't really change their voice. And from research I've done, people who have experienced a traumatic event like this commonly say, "I'll never forget his voice." And Sheriff Don Gudmundson says that investigators should have had Heinrich read lines that the man responsible for these attacks had said during his crimes, because all the victims said the same thing. The man had a low, raspy voice. Another thing that seems, I guess, sort of missed, is that Trevor and Aaron, again the two boys that were with Jacob that night, didn't get to see this lineup, and none of the victims from the Painesville assaults got to see the lineup either. Also on this day, the day of the lineup, the examination results come in from Heinrich's vehicle tires that were collected, and they come back consistent with the tracks at the crime scene. Now, the search for Jacob continues. Even though the tire tracks come back a match, they aren't arresting Heinrich, and they're also still looking for the person responsible for the attack of Jared. On February 9th, 1990, it seems like they have their guy, in Jared's case anyway. The FBI found a fiber that was taken from Heinrich's car, the one he owned at the time Jared was assaulted, and guess what? That fiber in his car matched a fiber that was found on Jared's snowsuit from that day. So, Heinrich is arrested for the abduction and assault of Jared Shirell. According to APM reports, one detective says Heinrich was actually drunk when he was arrested. And I'm going to go back, or rather jump forward, I guess, to Stearns County Sheriff Don Gudmundson again. And again, I think this is like around 2018 when he's interviewed for the case. Now, he wasn't on the case back then in 89 and 90. I believe he took over as sheriff in 2017. But he definitely isn't shy about pointing out mistakes that were made in both Jared's case and Jacob's case. He says the FBI agents who interrogated Heinrich back then were inexperienced. They didn't know what they were doing, and he says they didn't know that he was a suspect in the Painesville assaults. Now, when they're questioning Heinrich, he tells them he knows nothing about the assault on Jared and that he's being framed. Remember, he's been interviewed before for Jared's attack, and one of the times was just days after it happened. Well, they end up making the decision that they think Heinrich is actually innocent, and they release him the very next day. The reporter within the dark actually asked the FBI agent who interrogated Heinrich that day whether or not he had heard about the Painesville assaults. But the agent says, "No, I didn't know about them. Had I known about them, I would have definitely interviewed the boys from Painesville." But the thing is, law enforcement were made aware of the Painesville assaults. Remember the boy and his dad who went to the Stearns County Sheriff's Department the month after Jacob was kidnapped? They told them about the Painesville attacks and how they think it's the same guy that took Jacob. And remember, it took them 2.5 months to actually speak with the Painesville police about it. And when they did finally speak with the police chief of Painesville himself tells them, "Yeah, we have all these assaults on these young boys, but we have no one arrested for it." And then he even tells them, "I think Danny Heinrich needs to be considered as a suspect." And the boy and his dad who went to the Stearns County Sheriff's Department says no one even talked to them after this. No one followed up with them after they left the Sheriff's Department that day. The boy was never asked to do a lineup or look at photos of suspects, nothing. Then comes February 17th, 1990, which would have been Jacob's 12th birthday. This was the day the Jacob Wetterling Foundation was launched. This foundation was to focus on the prevention and elimination of stranger abductions of children. $200,000 had been raised by the time of this launch. Now, more and more time passes, leads still come in, but none of them were the leads that the Wetterlings were hoping for. And then came October 22nd, 1990, the one-year anniversary of Jacob's disappearance. Around 1,000 people had gathered to remember Jacob and remember that he was still out there somewhere. Then a few more months passed without getting any closer to finding him. Then, in early 1991, according to an episode of In the Dark, a Painesville officer notices a vehicle that seems to be following paper boys while on their routes. The officer follows the car, and then he sees the man driving. Now, by this time, a little over a year since Jacob's been missing, they're very familiar with who Danny Heinrich is. So, when they see the man driving, they immediately know who it is. It's Danny Heinrich. But the officer didn't do anything. Just because he seemed suspicious and was possibly following these boys around, technically he hasn't done anything illegal, so he just lets it go. Then the next month, February 1991, one morning in the Painesville paper, there was a heading that told people to be alert, that there had been 3 calls to police about a suspicious man spotted by children in the area, and that this man would watch the children and then try to approach them. The article says that the man is of medium build and that he drives a blue car. Now, who do we know that drives a blue car? Danny Heinrich. Then the following month, March of 1991, investigators interview a man named Dwayne Hart. Hart is a sex offender who is in prison at the time. Now, he was actually previously interviewed about Jacob's abduction, but it was believed that he had nothing to do with it. In 1990, he was convicted of sexually assaulting 4 boys in Minnesota. Now, interesting thing here, according to APM reports, Jared Shirell knew about Dwayne Hart, and he actually wanted to go and speak with Hart while he was behind bars. And I'm talking back when Jared was just 12 years old after his assault. He wanted to be able to hear Hart's voice so he would know if he was the man who assaulted him, or if his attacker was still out there. But he wasn't allowed to talk with Hart. So Dwayne Hart is actually a friend of Danny Heinrich's older brother, and he and Danny Heinrich would actually hang out occasionally as well. He was about 16 years older than Danny Heinrich, and according to the episode of In the Dark, Hart says that he and Danny actually had had sex before. According to the Twin Cities Pioneer Press, Hart says he was at Danny Heinrich's apartment the month Jacob was abducted. He says while he was there, he saw 2 police scanners, a handgun, and a ninja-type suit. Hart then says Heinrich actually asked him how to get rid of a body. Now, you would think that after this, investigators would at least go back and look at Heinrich a little bit more, but they don't. Hart even tells them that he thinks Heinrich took Jacob. Sheriff Don Gunmanson, who again took over in 2017, says, quote, "Based on the reading of the file, it's not apparent that any follow-up was done on this information," end quote. Now, around the 2-year anniversary of Jacob's disappearance, the investigation slows down and kind of comes to a stall. Years pass, there's no sign of Jacob, and some people seem to forget, but not the Wetterlings. Patty becomes a national advocate for children, and as I previously mentioned, Patty and Jerry founded the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center, which works to help prevent child exploitation. And in 1994, Jacob's parents successfully lobbied Congress to pass the Jacob Wetterling Act, which requires states to register sex offenders. In August of 1997, a computer-enhanced photo is created to show what Jacob would look like then, at age 19. It's sent out to 73 million U.S. homes. And then more years pass and nothing. Then comes the 10-year anniversary of Jacob's abduction, October 22, 1999. NBC aired an episode reminding the public that Jacob is still missing and don't forget about him. They showed footage of Aaron and Trevor back then from 1989, explaining what the man told them when he took Jacob. Then they show Patty, and she says, quote, "I don't get to control what happened to Jacob. I only can control what I do with it," end quote. And something kind of neat and something that brought hope, actually known as Jacob's Hope, was each October 22nd, on the anniversary of Jacob's disappearance, Minnesotans would leave their porch lights on. This was our way of saying, we all want Jacob to come home. Now, I know I sort of jump around a little bit with explaining and detailing this case, but that's because some things that are pertinent from, say, the early 90s, we weren't made aware of until like 2015 or even later. So in the years after Jacob's disappearance, we know that law enforcement didn't get any closer to solving this case. Again, now this is 10 years after Jacob's been missing in 1999 and still nothing. Then a few more years pass with still no new information. Remember, I mentioned the sheriff on the case was Sheriff Graft. Well, he ended up retiring, and then a different sheriff was on the case for a while who didn't get any closer to solving it either. And then came 2002. A man named John Sanner was elected as the Stearns County Sheriff, and Sheriff Sanner made comments like, "I'm gonna find the man responsible," and he would do everything he could possibly do to solve this case. Well, to do that, he needs to find a suspect. Now, you think maybe this new sheriff taking over would look into Heinrich more, since the others didn't seem to, and there seemed to be very good reason to look into him more, right? But he doesn't. Instead, this new Sheriff Sanner goes back to Dan Rassier. Remember, he's the 33-year-old man who lives at that farmhouse with his parents, and his driveway begins right at the very spot Jacob was taken. So they don't have any car leads. I mean, they do have Heinrich's car, his tires match, but for whatever reason, they're leaving that lead alone. So in their minds, there are no car leads, which brings them again to think that this guy had to have been on foot. And for him to have been on foot, he probably lives close by, which again brings them back to Dan Rassier. So they go back to Dan and basically tell him, just admit you took Jacob. Now, Dan says that even though he lived less than a mile from the Wetterlings, he says they never even actually knew each other. And when investigators started digging into Dan more, people in the community couldn't believe that they were looking at him as possibly being the man responsible for Jacob's abduction. According to APM reports, the Rassiers are a long-standing, very respected family in Stearns County. Dan's father, who has now unfortunately passed away, was the treasurer of St. Joseph Township, and Dan actually filled this position. Former St. Joseph Police Chief Bill Lorenz says of Dan Rassier, quote, "I knew Danny from way back, and I just could not visualize him being involved with anything like the Wetterling abduction, because he was brought up by his dad, who was very down to earth," end quote. Dan Rassier told In the Dark, quote, "I was home alone. People would say I was weird. I am weird. You're not married. You're living at home with your parents. You are weird. You did this," end quote. He was constantly harassed, and one thing that didn't make sense is that none of the shoes they looked at that belonged to Dan matched any of the prints at the crime scene. I mean, sure, he could have gotten rid of them, but they didn't find any. Now, investigators don't have anything they can arrest Dan on, but they keep pressing him, and they let him know that he's not off their radar. Then something crazy happens. In 2003, about 14 years after Jacob's disappearance, a man named Kevin comes forward. Now, we don't know his last name because he asked to remain anonymous. Kevin was 21 years old at the time of Jacob's abduction, and he remembers hearing something over a police scanner that night. Now, I'm going to read his statement to the police from October 21st, 2003. He tells detectives that he and his girlfriend were at her mother's house and that there was a police scanner in her kitchen. He says he was about to walk out the door and then heard something about bikes, maybe some mention of a mask. It was just really patchy, he says. And then it mentioned Tom Thumb, which again is the video store Jacob and the other two boys got the movie from. After hearing this, he says two or three squad cars went by the house heading towards Tom Thumb. So he decides to go check out what's going on. He and his girlfriend get in her car, and his girlfriend's brother and his wife get in their truck. Kevin says the reason he thought he would go and check out what was happening was because he thought he could help. His girlfriend's brother was on the St. Joseph Fire Department, so he figured maybe they could all go see what was happening and help out in some way. So they head to Tom Thumb. The detective asks him what his girlfriend's car looked like. He says he doesn't remember the make, but that it was a silver, mid-size car. The detective then asks, "Where did you go then?" Kevin says they went towards Tom Thumb, but once they got there, they didn't see any cop lights or anything going on. So they drove a little longer, and then his girlfriend's brother stopped them and said, "You know, me and my wife are just going to go home." So Kevin and his girlfriend keep driving around. They end up turning on a road, which they thought was just another dirt road, but it wasn't. It was Dan Rassier's driveway. Now, just to jog your memory, remember Dan said he saw two cars come up his driveway that night and turn around. Kevin says once he realized it was a driveway, he turned around and drove back out. He then says as he's driving out, his headlights ended up shining in the ditch in front of them, and there were bikes laying there. He says at the time he didn't realize it was a crime scene. He said he thought about putting the bikes in the car and bringing them to law enforcement because he remembered hearing something about bikes on the police scanner. He thought maybe they were stolen or something, but he decided against it and instead drove back towards Tom Thumb. He said when he got into town, there was a police car sitting in the parking lot of a dentist's office. So he pulled up and told the officer the story that he heard on the scanner, and he says, "I saw some bikes in a ditch." But he says all the officer said back was, "Yep, we know about it." And that's all the officer said. Kevin says the officer made it seem like he was just not even interested in what Kevin had to say, and that Kevin was bothering him. Now, at this time again, Kevin didn't know there was an abduction. He thought maybe the bikes were just stolen. He says he and his girlfriend then went home, but then, around 2 a.m. the next morning, he got a call from his girlfriend's brother, the one on the fire department. He asks Kevin if he turned around in a farmer's driveway, and Kevin says, "Yeah, why?" And the brother says, "Well, they're taking tire impressions of a car that turned around in there." And then he tells Kevin that a boy was abducted near there. He tells Kevin, "Get dressed because they're probably going to come to your house and question you." So Kevin says he gets dressed and he waits. He waited for them to come, but they never did. Now again, it's been 14 years at this point, the point where he's telling his statement to detectives. And he says he hasn't been interviewed once since this point. So why would Kevin come forward after 14 years then? I mean, he was never once on police radar, from what it seemed anyway. So why even come forward now? Well, one night in 2003, Kevin was at a party where he told his story to a man he met there. The man ended up being a U.S. Marshal, and he tells Kevin, "You really need to go tell investigators about what you did that night." Now, even though it took Kevin 14 years to come forward, law enforcement was aware that he was at the crime scene. Remember, he told that cop who was sitting in the police car in the dentist parking lot, and that cop didn't even seem to care at all. So they did previously know, it just took them 14 years to actually listen.